Supporting WGTD is Carthage College, combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. For more information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities, you're invited to visit carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very pleased that for the first time in 2015, I can welcome into our studios Professor Art Sear, a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College, director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and someone who joins us on a monthly basis to offer his own perspective on various issues of concern, both here and abroad. And as usual, there is no shortage of pressing issues for us to be talking about for the next few minutes. So without further ado, Professor Sear, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Professor Berg, especially because your heat is working so nicely this morning.
We have a nice cozy studio today.
Yes, indeed.
Glad about that. So we appreciate you making the trip. Of course, nothing is dominating the headlines at the moment quite like the recent terrorist attacks which occurred in France. And, of course, one of the reasons is that these attacks occurred in a place that we don't maybe immediately even associate with such terrorist attacks. But there it is. And, of course, almost as significant as those attacks themselves and the loss of life and so on has been the enormous outpouring of support for the people of France, and in particular that extraordinary gathering of not only regular citizens but leaders from all kinds of countries all over the world flocking to Paris.
Yes.
To express their support. I wonder what your reaction was, first of all, to those attacks, and then to the response of the world, in a sense, since then.
Well, there's no easy answer, but I think it's important to be as pointed as possible, and I think it was absolutely terrific that France, especially a country that nowadays wrongly, but historically was rightly associated with rather weak and ineffective government, and a country often at odds with the United States, has led the way in terms of popular reaction and popular protest on a mass scale against these despicable murderous attacks. And I think the fact that so many world leaders participated really underscores the fact that for all our problems and difficulties, since the end of the Cold War, we really have developed not only a wider understanding and appreciation for the rule of law, but also we have an international system where the norms and procedures of civilized government are becoming more widespread. The French and the American people are united. They were vital, vital allies in our own revolution. The French Navy was crucial to George Washington's decisive victory over the British at Yorktown. The French provided other support. That 18th century rock star Benjamin Franklin was a crucial catalyst in winning over French public opinion. The French Revolution occurred not long after the American Revolution, but we're different in different ways. My perception of our revolution was it was much more individualistic in terms of the focus of the rights of man. Our French allies, like Europeans generally, on the continent at least, tend to emphasize collective action and mass action. And the French Revolution really, in Paris at least, was a mass uprising. That's a very strong tradition in the French political system, and we should all be glad that that tradition is being directed in such positive ways. That hasn't always been the case in France, especially during the Second World War. It's a terrible tragedy, and we shouldn't overlook that, but it's given the fact that we worry so much collectively in this country, especially about violence and terrorism, we should feel good about this popular reaction, I think.
One of the things that, of course, it was striking about this succession of attacks in France was that one of them, and the one that really maybe in some ways attracted the most attention, and I'm pretty sure actually resulted in the greatest loss of life, was the very concerted attack on this French satirical newspaper.
Yeah.
And so here are...
Charlie Hebdo.
Right. And so here are terrorist extremists going after people who draw cartoons for a living, mm-hmm. and make people laugh while they make people think for a living. And to think about somebody like that in the crosshairs of this kind of attack is kind of striking. On the other hand, because of what we just experienced in terms of the film The Interview and North Korea's objections to that, although they went after it in a different way with different weapons, but in a sense the same kind of freedom of expression is under attack in both of those arenas.
Absolutely. And people on the edge, perhaps satirists most of all, perhaps really crude and vulgar satirists, which applies in this case, offensive to a lot of people beyond politics, they're sort of the canary in the coal mine in terms of how free we are, in fact. There have been incidents, this is not unprecedented, there have been incidents in the Low Countries, again involving cartoons, but you're probably right to focus on this particular part of the media, especially today.
One of the points of criticism in the wake of the attacks in France and this then huge demonstration was the absence of any high-level U.S. officials at that event, and ultimately the White House's acknowledgement that they made a mistake,
yeah.
that somebody should have been there. Your reaction?
Well, everything's clear in hindsight. We did have our ambassador there. I believe an assistant secretary of state was there, and there were other American officials. But the positive reaction, the rather surprising to me, decision of so many heads of government to participate, including the British Prime Minister, really shows not only the importance of the positive reaction to these terrible events, but also probably the White House was taken by surprise. And they said, I think, appropriately, we should have had someone more senior there.
Hmm.
On the other hand, it is a way of emphasizing the importance of Europe. We debate endlessly in this country. We feel entirely too sorry for ourselves, in my view, in the past. And at the present, we feel we're the martyr. We're doing everything for the Europeans, including in the area of defense, which actually is not true. We, in fact, are not an empire in any traditional sense, and the more Europeans can be on their own and show their own solidarity, the better. Britain and France are historic rivals and have been enemies in the past. France and Germany were bitter rivals, bitter enemies, and fought three bloody wars in the last century and a half, the World Wars and the Franco-Prussian Wars. The fact that there's been this tremendous Franco-German rapprochement. Speaking of visual imagery, one of the most touching and important photographs I've seen in my life was from several decades ago when the president of France, Mitterrand, and the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl were at Verdun, where literally more than 500,000 men were killed in the most grotesque and horrible fashion in the trench warfare in a rather short period of time, literally a matter of days. The two of them were holding hands and meditating over the battlefield. That photograph was widely distributed. One of the most important developments of many positive developments in our lifetime is this Germany and France coming back together again. And the fact that the President of the United States wasn't there, I think, was helpful, actually, in terms of emphasizing the importance of regional cooperation and good feeling in Europe, which has been this horrible battlefield, especially in the 20th century, in these
right.
terrible world wars.
That's interesting you should say that, because, of course, one of the in the immediate wake of that, when some of that first criticism was lobbied at the White House, one of the things they said was, well, it means so much security when the president of the United States, you know, is in any kind of a situation like that, you know, in an open air event, and they feared that it would be his presence would be disruptive and a distraction more than anything. I don't think at the time that official was referring at all in the way that you were. But in fact, what you're saying is kind of the same thing in a different way, that his presence would have been, in a sense, also a distraction from what you're thinking was a more important matter, the coming together again of Germany and France and some of the other allies, their immediate neighbors. That needed to be the most important story.
I don't want to be the cynical old professor too much, but you're paraphrasing the Washington bureaucratic functionary, I think, trying to get points with the boss and collectively cover the posterior of the administration.
Right.
That's
well, of course.
As usual in politics. I think to the White House, the credit of the White House collectively, they recovered ground and did better than that. So now saying, yes, we should have sent somebody.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. I'm talking about what they first said.
Yeah.
The first thing they said.
That's
in the
business as usual in politics.
Of course. Of course.
Self-importance and rationalization and, yeah.
Right. But, I mean, the point I'm making is he was talking about being the president would have been a distraction in a very tangible kind of way with all the security and so on. And what you're saying is, in a sense, his presence there would have been a distraction, in a sense, more figuratively.
All right, fair enough. But I think what you're quoting is basically baloney, as usual.
I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm just struck by the fact that while they were talking in certain terms, you're talking in other terms about
right. Okay.
the kind of distraction
fair
he
enough.
Would have been. That's all I'm saying.
You're a very nice person.
One thing that is striking about this current situation is that we have this widespread outpouring of concern and outrage about these attacks which occurred in France. And almost simultaneously to them have been terrible terrorist attacks in Nigeria, which have certainly involved the deaths of hundreds of people and perhaps the death of a couple of thousand people. And but these are attacks that are not generating nearly the same level of concern, and nobody is marching by the tens of thousands in protest of what's going on there. It's a striking phenomenon, and I suppose part of the problem is when certain attacks occur and matters of moral outrage occur in remote parts of the globe, even in this era in which we're all so tightly connected. Those events tend not to be responded to in quite the same way. What do you think is going on there?
I think you make a very important point. President Clinton has said more than once, and I believe wrote in his memoirs, that among his most important mistakes, and he was extremely self-critical in a very unusual way, of his presidency was not intervening aggressively and quickly in the genocide in Rwanda, which occurred during his administration and during his watch. By contrast, we were quite active in intervening in the Balkans. In hindsight, I was really an intervention that really began during the George H.W. Bush administration. I was, at the time, concerned about whether we might be getting into a quagmire and just how clear our rationale was. In hindsight, the intervention in Serbia and Bosnia and the region more generally was the right move for the NATO alliance, especially given the way the tribunals have worked out. But relatively few people were killed. I don't want to sound at all cold-blooded. Whether it's one death or many, it's to be regretted and to be thought about. But not many people were killed, actually. There were lots of atrocities. It was very brutal. It also got a lot of media coverage and still continues to resonate, especially concerning crimes against civilians. By contrast, hundreds of thousands, over a million people can be killed in Africa, and we don't pay nearly as much attention. I hadn't thought about this before you mentioned it just before the program. But you're onto a very good point. I do think that situation is changing, even though the killings by Boko Haram in Nigeria are not getting much media coverage. That's why a program like yours is important. Mm-hmm.
In one of your more recent blogs, you wrote about this other matter, which I just touched on briefly, but we certainly should spend at least a little bit of time talking about this whole matter of North Korea's outrage over the release of this film called The Interview and their cyber attack on Sony and the fallout from all of that. It was a really interesting article that you wrote, in which
thank you. I'm glad of that.
as you were commenting on these events, you were thinking back to some of the experiences which you had in Chicago, which involved kind of a similar matter of whether or not you stand up for the right of free expression or not. I wonder if you could in particular tell our listeners, recount one of the stories you talk about in that blog entry about a bomb threat which forced a meeting that you were part of to be sort of adjourned and, you know, reconvened in safer circumstances. I mean, this is kind of scary stuff I'd not heard about before.
I thought you were going to mention Salman Rushdie, that case.
Well, eventually, but...
Okay, well, thank you for bringing it up. I worked for 2 decades at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, and our mission was we developed a research and analysis and publications arm, but our principal mission was public education, both for the public at large, including a very large public membership at the time, and also the corporate community, not through any courageous decision by me or anyone else, and not through any... admirable commitment to the First Amendment, but through a comedy of errors, a very loyal, very effective in many ways, not the most sophisticated member of our staff, was deceived into lining up an official of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, back in the late 70s, to speak at the council. At the time, we considered them a terrorist organization formally. Since that time, Israel... and the PLO have had a rapprochement, and the Israelis are now focused on other groups. They were seen as a terrorist organization. We had no diplomatic relations. They did have an observer delegation at the UN, and this one individual, Shafiq El-Hood, had gotten State Department permission to travel around the U.S. All that by way of background, but this was no conscious decision on our part. It was my mistake in not... being more thorough and systematic in reviewing our upcoming program. And I learned about this when the chairman of our board, John D. Gray, who was chairman also of Hart, Schaffner & Marx, a very important clothing firm, called me up at home on a Friday night because some equally senior and very influential corporate associates of his, members of the Jewish business community, most of them in the same industry, were raising hell about this. And thanks to the vagaries of travel, the president of our organization happened to be in Europe at the time, and I wound up dealing with Mr. Gray more than I usually would have. Jack was extremely impressive, a very honest man, a very earthy man, very Truman-esque is the way I think of him. And he and I had a chance to talk directly about this, and I told him, Jack, if we give in on this, every fanatic in the community will be after us. And much to his credit, he agreed with me. When I came into the office early the next week, already, this is long before the internet, but my desk was groaning with piles of mail and telegrams and special delivery messages from various people, most of them members of the Jewish population in the U.S. I felt like I was hearing from every rabbi in North America. We didn't cancel the meeting. At a board meeting at about the same time, coincidentally, it was an interesting education for me. Jack said we should, you know, this is a principle of freedom in our country, and we have to stand on this principle. And our board was heavily corporate in nature, and these polished pinstripe executives, I noticed, had been studiously avoiding me and saying nothing during the meeting. But as soon as our chairman spoke up, we turned into a meeting of the ACLU. It was like an opera, one pinstripe suit after another Foursquare. Jack, you're so courageous. You're so great. It was a good lesson to me. I had a wife and two young children at home. She was not employed. I could have been out of a job if Jack had decided the other way, believe me. And it was a good lesson in life for me.
Absolutely.
But the stakes are very high. I appreciate you bringing that up.
Well, and I don't remember if it was that board meeting or another, but you mentioned in the blog how one meeting was interrupted by a bomb threat, and you reconvened in the stairwell of the meeting to continue the conversation and so on. I mean, so... This was serious stuff we're talking about. And
yes,
you do,
but it wasn't a way of life, let me say. It was a demanding job in terms. I'm very proud of what we accomplished collectively. John Riley, our longtime president of the council, who was extremely skillful at dealing with the business community, especially the corporate community. We never had a budget deficit. We grew in real terms, even during years of high inflation. And most of what we did was... not highly controversial in nature, but concerning the Middle East especially, the meeting we're referring to just now was with Paul Findlay, a very independent congressman who was critical of Israel's foreign policy. I certainly don't believe he was anti-Semitic. He was eventually defeated, but we had a bomb threat at the Arts Club in Chicago, telephoned in, and the manager, unfortunately, responded to the phone call that he got by marching into the lecture hall and shouting at the top of his lungs, there is a bomb.
Oh, dear.
In fact, there wasn't, but we reconvened in the stairwell because I was not going to cancel the damn meeting because,
Wow. Well, you do in this blog entry mention, of course, author Salman Rushdie and the enormous controversy that surrounded him and the very real... very ominous threats against his life that were made, and he was fortunate to survive all of that. But it is the very same issue of freedom that is of course at stake. Explain how your column goes on then to talk about someone by the name of Frederick Lindemann, and what the connection is between these more contemporary events and. This associate of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
We should probably mention briefly that Salman Rushdie, again, this happened some years ago, back at the end of the 80s. He's a very, very successful novelist and became a celebrity, for better and worse, as a result of the fact that one of his books in the 80s, The Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, not many years after the U.S.-Iran hostage crisis and the Iran Revolution, decided the book was so offensive that Rushdie should be murdered, which is what these fatwas that are declared. That's a polite way, I think, of saying, I want this person murdered. Hmm. And Rushdie was the target of threats. There was no effort, as far as I know, to kill him. And he is still alive and now living openly in Britain. Not surprisingly, that's where he's found the most congenial home. But he lived in hiding for many years. As a result of this threat, Walden Books, again, this is long before Amazon and the Internet for the benefit of younger listeners, Walden Books despicably removed the book from their shelves. And two other chains, I believe, I won't mention them, they temporarily... but then rescinded their decision and put the book back. Bill Sapphire, a very conservative columnist whom I admire a lot, wonderful writer, and a veteran of the Nixon White House and campaigns, very conservative writer, wrote a very gripping column to me, support your local bookstores. Walden Books had been very friendly to Sapphire in promoting one of his novels, and he was a good friend of the CEO. But after this, Sapphire wrote, let's not rely, and it bears directly on the world of Amazon and other big internet monopolies and other commercial monopolies today. He said, support small bookstores, support your independent retailer. This is crucial to our freedom. On your other point, the Rushdie case is rather similar, and Satanic Verses became a runaway bestseller,
right?
Just as The Interview, which by all accounts is not a particularly good movie, has become a huge hit. Frederick Lindemann was a very interesting, not very well-known intellectual and professor in Britain. He had a very comfortable endowed chair at Oxford University in physics and philosophy, I believe. He didn't publish a great deal. He was a very, very unusual and argumentative analyst. He was also, by all accounts, a first-class jerk. Just very, very difficult to deal with. If he went to a garden party and two ladies were wearing the same dress, he would point that out in a loud voice, or if some man had a soup stain on his tie, Dr. Lindemann would point that out, and Celia Sands, Churchill's very refined daughter, described him in writing as antisocial. And he suffered, even though he had this great chair. Anti-Semitism in 1930s Britain no doubt was a factor. But quite apart from the general prejudices at the time, Professor Lindemann's problem was himself and his own personality. He was a rather isolated and lonely figure in many ways. He never married, although after he became a powerful government figure, he had a very active social life, from what I've read. Churchill loved him, couldn't get enough Lindemann, even though the women in his family didn't care for him, and Churchill's long-suffering, extremely important and supportive wife, Clementine, tried to dissuade Winston. Lindemann was frequently a country house guest on weekends, and Churchill couldn't get enough of his company. After Churchill returned from the wilderness to become Secretary of the Navy, in effect, head of the Admiralty, at the beginning of World War II in Europe, he brought Lindemann in and gave him an office next to his, and Lindemann had one mission, which was to criticize the conventional, tear apart the conventional wisdom, the practices, the plans of the Navy. Whatever the admirals are doing, let's see what's wrong with it. After the fall of France, Churchill became prime minister, and Lindemann got a much bigger office and a much bigger staff and tremendous freedom. He wasn't assigned a lot of specific missions, but Churchill told him emphatically and unequivocally, in effect, Frederick, whatever plans are proposed by the military, by the civil servants, by the politicians, by the members of this government, including the prime minister, your mission is to find out what's wrong with them and pick them apart. Churchill told him unequivocally that he was sure his buddy would enjoy the work, but he also expected him to excel. And when you read the history of the time, Lindemann had all kinds of screwy ideas, but he was also very good at shaking up the status quo and finding flaws. And he recruited a staff of individuals similar to himself, and I developed the case, this imagination, this lack of conformity was crucial to Allied victory.
So it flies in the...
Survival. I mean, that's a war we could have lost. Survival early in the war. It's a war that especially younger people, I must say, they sort of assume our victory. That was not the case back then. It's important to emphasize. And this openness, which also characterized the Roosevelt administration, was crucial. Very increasingly strong contrast with the enforced conformity and spiral of brutality and lockstep that characterized the Third Reich and also their various allies.
And you're suggesting that that also characterizes the current mindset of these perpetrators of terrorism. I mean, that they are also hoping to enforce on the world their view of utter conformity and of silencing voices that defend them.
Well, that's well put. It's perhaps too generous. But yes, that's why I was trying to link it, at some level, I was trying to link this history with these current developments.
Fascinating.
And it gets at your emphasis on the outpouring of popular support in Paris. Very, very different, much freer and a much more prosperous environment than in earlier periods. The fact that thousands and thousands of people could drop whatever they were doing, didn't have to worry about getting to work the next day. It's now no great difficulty for most people to travel in the industrial nations. We really live in a much richer and more secure time in that sense than was the case in the 30s.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Professor Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center there. Closer to home, we have, of course,
I should note, since we're sensitive to prejudices and the importance of equity, as well as equality today. Lindemann became Lord Cherwell after the war. He was treated well at Oxford, but he was treated even better by the British collectively and their government after the war. He really was quite honored for this service to the country, and he should have been.
Huh. Well, and that story is fascinating.
Lord Cherwell, yes.
Yeah, and that's a story I didn't know who that was at all. That was a brand new name to me.
Well, that's why we academics are around, right? Why else?
Well, and of course, that whole notion of purposefully having somebody at your side who's there as the perpetual devil's advocate, I mean, there to shoot down every wonderful idea or shoot holes through it. And I mean, there are a lot of people who don't operate that way at all, who would just soon have a obedient yes man at their shoulder. Much better way of doing business, whatever your business happens to be. Let's go closer to home to the new Congress, which is now in session. A very interesting couple of years now that are about to unfold and unfolding already. And one of the stories, of course, is about the Republican Party on Capitol Hill and to what extent they can be a unified force to whatever extent they can achieve unity. Of course, they're going to be very much a force to be reckoned with. What is your sense about the dynamics on Capitol Hill right now, and particularly within the Republican Party?
The public has so clearly and explicitly expressed exasperation, to put it mildly, with the gridlock in Washington that my guess is the Republicans will be looking for ways to be bipartisan as well as effective in getting policies through. Whether or not you support President Obama and the current administration, I think people would agree, the evidence is clear, that this is not a particularly assertive administration in terms of dealing on a continuing basis at the top, especially with Congress. The fact that the Republican numbers in the House increased, I haven't done a detailed examination of who's who in the new House of Representatives, but my strong inference is the Tea Party has faded considerably, especially compared to 2010, which will make John Boehner's job easier. Historically, the Speaker of the House has not always been the highly partisan office it's become in recent decades. Mm. The longest-serving Speaker of the House in the 20th century was Sam Rayburn, especially in the 40s when we were emulating the British in a way that we don't today. The Speaker of the Parliament really is above the partisan fray there. And Rayburn, who was not a big student of history or an intellectual, nonetheless, he functioned very much that way as Speaker and indeed as Democratic Minority Leader for a time in the 40s and early 50s. And I think there's an opportunity, given the current climate of public opinion, to return to that. It's easy for an academic to talk. We'll see what happens, but I do think politicians survive and prosper, and he's been very effective at his career so far because they respond to public opinion, especially in the House. And I would look for more, less grandstanding, less kind of obvious efforts to put down the White House and more efforts at collegiality. And Boehner is in a position to do that, especially soon after he's been reelected Speaker. Mitch McConnell, by public accounts and his own statements, does not want to be President of the United States, which may make him unique in the U.S. Congress, but I'm sure it's not. But he really wants to be a great Senate Majority Leader. Mm. We live in a very partisan time. Historically, however, the Senate welcomes eccentricity then and now. They welcome, in a way, independence. They certainly tolerate it far more easily than in the House, and they should. Mm. And he has been a great deal maker. I also think Paul Ryan, our local congressman, who's ruled himself out just in the current news of running for president in 2016, he's really been driving the budget debate in Congress, whether you like or don't like the Republican proposals. There has not been a comparable Democratic alternative. Through willpower, intellect, energy, and a very good staff, he's really been defining in detail budget proposals that will have a big impact on the government, I believe, over time, even if the Republicans don't retake the White House in 2016. Hmm. So I would look to the Senate. McConnell, surprisingly to my view, has been extremely blunt in public in his expressing his negative view of the leadership skills of the president. That's just a fact of life. He's been surprisingly public, at least from my point of view. So he also has a challenge in dealing with the White House. But he is a very, very effective deal maker. And again, the fact that he's not obsessed with getting to the White House, another very strong Senate leader, for instance, Lyndon Johnson, was, there's an opportunity for McConnell with these big majorities to be a really effective legislative leader.
Right. That can be a big legacy for someone to leave behind them.
Yeah. And there are areas of possible agreement, tax reform, trade. In both those areas, mentioning Congressman Ryan, really serious, effective, smart congressional leaders can have a big impact on federal policy. And transportation infrastructure, where we've been using literally Band-Aids, taking funds from that aren't there for highways as stopgap measures, there is a huge need to update the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System, which is literally falling apart. And in those three areas, I think there are real opportunities for cooperation and for President Obama to recover ground historically and be a very active executive leader in the last 2 years.
Among the conundrums facing our leaders is the challenge of trying to perpetuate the economic recovery, which is certainly slow but certain in a lot of ways, but a couple of things kind of remain stubbornly in place, although there have been some encouraging numbers in terms of job creation. But of course, unemployment rates, those have kind of remained stubbornly high compared to other aspects of the economy in terms of strength of recovery. That recovery has been slower. Another aspect has been the stagnation of wages, that our wages remain quite low, at least in the opinion of a lot of people. And I suppose we're talking about a lot of competing forces that affect those kind of things.
Yeah, that's a very important, and it's a very long-term problem, undeniably, statistically, since the early 1970s. The differential in income and between those, the glib references to the top 1%, between the top 10%, even top 20%, but especially the top 10%, and smaller percentage of the population, and the rest of the population, has grown dramatically. Statistically, it's very comparable to the Gilded Age and then the 1920s, which resulted in the Great Crash and the Great Depression and real class warfare in this country, which is something Americans don't usually embrace. We did during the 1930s. I don't think we're facing a crisis similar to that crisis for all kinds of reasons, but you're right, it's an extremely important problem. And it's something that's more of a problem for the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. After this big win, it's very easy to be of the Republicans. In the congressional elections, it's very easy to get a little, not only be gratified, but also be complacent. I think this theme, which Obama used very effectively in both presidential campaigns, especially running in 2012 against the head of Bain Capital, kind of personified modern capitalism for many people, that's a continuing challenge for the Republican Party and for Americans. It's just not healthy for a very, very small percentage of the population to have such vast holdings of not just income but capital. It's really bad.
One of the realities right now that, at least for us directly in terms of our own pocketbooks, feels nothing but positive is the drastic drop in oil prices, the lowest that I believe they've been in 5 years. And, of course, that's starting to be reflected quite dramatically at the gas pump. But there are some observers who caution us to not be entirely ecstatic about that, because there are ramifications for our economy and maybe even more seriously for the global economy when oil prices fall like that. But do you see that mostly as a positive and nothing we need to be particularly concerned about?
Yes, I think it's mostly a positive, to give you a brief answer for a change. Keep in mind, I was listening to NPR, of course, as I was scrambling up here to get to your program on time this morning, and there was an earnest younger bank economist talking about consumer spending. It's down. He was good enough to mention the fact that people are getting the same amount of gasoline for a lot less, and that is a factor, but they're not spending in other areas. Harry Truman said famously, "I really would like to find a one-armed economist, because you fellas are always saying on the one hand, Mr. President, but on the other hand." Overall, it's good. It's good in a strategic sense, which is a continuing theme in these conversations you and I have. Up until 1960, the U.S. was a net oil exporter to a significant degree. From the 1800s and John D. Rockefeller's initial empire up until the 60s. In 1960, OPEC tried an oil embargo, and it didn't work. It fell apart very quickly. In 1973, our dependency and others had grown so great on OPEC members that they were able to pull this off. That kind of concentration of wealth, again, was very inimical. It was very disruptive to our economy. It really stoked, it greatly increased the inflation that Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara had put in place during the Vietnam War. It vastly increased that problem. We became preoccupied with this dependency on foreign oil. I believe in important ways Jimmy Carter was a very successful president, and increasingly will be seen that way. I was listening to some right-wing talk show host, I will confess, while I was commuting late last night, who was, sneering at Jimmy Carter as usual. Part of the image of weakness and being beleaguered that greatly afflicted him during his one term was a function of this dependency on foreign oil. And we would almost neurotically, including President Carter, emphasize that theme. The second oil shocks in 79 reinforced that. The situation is now transformed, and we're back, if we play our cards right, to an environment where American power was greatly used and greatly effective during the war, but also afterwards, especially during the Eisenhower administration, because we had this tremendous control over resources. It means that Russia's position is even worse. It means that we have an opportunity to work together with difficult countries, including our Turkish allies, an important transshipment, given geography, an important transshipment place for oil and natural gas. They already are, but we can use our resources to greatly strengthen that. It means that Russia's leverage and the Arab states' leverage will steadily decline, as long as we play our cards right. It's a tremendous, tremendous opportunity. Our history is too easily overlooked because we were conscious of dependency for so long. In the early 1930s, my dad, as a very young man in Chicago, found that he was literally starving to death. He could not make a living. He could not find a job that would pay a living wage in Chicago, and he wouldn't take relief, which was available, but not much. So he got on freight trains and went down to Texas and worked in the oil fields. It was extremely grueling labor. It was very dangerous, more dangerous than today. But the oil industry continued to grow and continued to offer lots and lots of employment, even during the Great Depression, because our global role was so tremendous. And we feel so bad about so much of the news of the world and these terrible. This is a tremendous opportunity for Americans. And one thing we're good at historically, collectively, is seizing strategic opportunities, as long as we have the right leadership. I think it's great.
In our closing minutes, a couple of matters.
You shouldn't look so concerned.
I'm only concerned about the time, because I have two more things I want to ask you about, and not enough time for us to really
I'll
get through.
I'll be brief. I'm sorry.
No. I'm glad you've said everything you've said, but let's touch real quick on a couple of other matters. One of them, I think, occurred since you were last on the program, namely the reestablishment of diplomatic ties between America and Cuba.
Right.
How significant do you see that?
I think that's very significant. There are very, very few dictatorships left. Latin America used to be festooned, literally carpeted with dictatorships, except for Costa Rica. Continuously, other countries would briefly experiment with democracy, and then it would fall back. After the early 1960s, there was a tremendous return to authoritarian regime and realistic fears about the Cuban Revolution being exported elsewhere in the Americas. Cuba is the only dictatorship left. even the Venezuelans, who are going to become weaker thanks to American oil, shale oil production. The Venezuelans, whose leverage is shrinking, even when Chavez was there, they had to have elections and face the people. Opening relations with Cuba means that the last bastion of communism is going to be falling, I believe. Mm. Not tomorrow, not next week, probably not for a few years at least, but it will go down. Mm.
I liked how in one of your recent columns talking about kind of the positive sweep of history and talking about how democracy is spreading around the globe, and you referred to how in many, many places there have been reasonably honest elections, which I think is a good way to put it. I mean, that often when democracy first takes hold someplace, it is not pristine, but there's something to be said for even reasonably honest elections versus the drastic alternatives.
Having worked in Chicago for a couple of decades, I'm conscious of the fact that even in advanced democracies, things aren't always pristine.
Right. Life very seldom is. Well, I think
we'll
save for next time an examination of the kind of the economic state of the world, including certain developments in China and other parts of that world, and sort of what's going on in the world of trade and so on. I think we also want to have a conversation about what the CIA likes to call enhanced interrogation, and of course, relatively recent revelations about that. And in a recent blog, you trace America's surprisingly long history in terms of the development of the laws of warfare. We have a very deep stake in that. And
that is just my view. I was commuting later last night because I was invited to a seminar at the University of Chicago, and I can state honestly that one of the senior professors I was dealing with down there went out of his way to denounce my optimism and emphasis on the law-abiding nature of the U.S., so I appreciate the chance to sound off on your good program, sir, but it's just my view.
Right. Well, we look forward to you returning to us in February to do more of the same.
Thank you.
Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College, it's always great to have you here. Thank you so much. Happy
Feelings
New Year
mutual.
To you.
Happy New Year.
Good to have you here. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. On Friday, we'll lighten up matters considerably with a conversation about Star Trek, the original series. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. More information available at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois calls for partly sunny skies this morning, increasing clouds, though, as the day proceeds. Our high temperature today will be 20 degrees, normal high 29. Mostly cloudy overnight, a low of 14 degrees. And tomorrow, under partly sunny skies, we should be warming to 30 degrees. And actually, it's looking like on Saturday, we will have a high in the upper 30s. Not quite so warm on Sunday. Dry conditions should continue for the balance of the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.